Good morning. You're listening to Community Focus on WCLK. I'm Public Affairs producer Rob Maynard. Today, we're talking with Doug Shipman. He is CEO of the National Center for Civil and Human Rights. We're focusing on the upcoming CNN Dialogues event called Modern Marchers, Lessons from the Front Lines of Social Change. That event takes place Thursday evening, September 12th at the Carter Center. And if you'd like more information about this event, you can find it at civilandhumanrights.org. Good morning, Mr. Shipman. Thanks for joining us.
Sure, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
What can people expect who are going to show up at the Carter Center next Thursday night for this CNN Dialogues?
Well, this is our eighth CNN Dialogue, and it's really a town hall style event. A moderator with a panel that for about the first half an hour talk about the issue in depth, their various perspectives on it. And then it becomes an audience Q&A give and take, where audience members ask questions, engage in certain topics that have been raised, and the panelists respond to that. There's also usually a very lively Twitter chat going on. So there's a virtual dialogue as well as the one that's happening inside the space. So it's usually quite deep, and it's also very interesting because the audience members are such a key part of it.
This dialogue's event is called Modern Marchers, Lessons from the Front Lines of Social Change. And, of course, this is taking a look back just a week ago at the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. America has changed an awful lot since 1963 in many ways for the better. What are the fundamental civil rights challenges of this new century?
Well, it's the challenges to some extent are still about who is included in issues of citizenship and issues of freedom, free expression. But the specifics of that have changed. Obviously, 1963 was a lot about African-American inclusion, especially in the United States South. Now it's about gay, lesbian folks. It's about immigrants of various statuses as far as their citizenship goes. It's about women. And some of those issues were on the table in 63, but some of those issues are relatively new. I think the other is that the modern marchers, and we use that term very specifically, sometimes it's literally marching, sometimes it's virtually marching. You see a lot of ways in which people virtually online are protesting, signing petitions, doing things from a social change perspective, organizing themselves. And so that's another aspect of this. It's not just about 250,000 people coming together for a day. It's about millions of people virtually coming together every day. And that has a power, but it also presents different kinds of challenges as well.
Could you talk a little bit about your moderator and your panelists, because this is about as diverse a group of people as you're going to see in one building at a time.
We try to make it a very diverse group, very different perspectives. The moderator is Michaela Pereira. She's from CNN. She hosts their morning program. She is going to be the one directing traffic. And then we have an academic from the University of Alabama named Arthur Dunning, who is also formerly involved in Georgia, who will give a perspective on history and how things have changed, what's happening today in the social space. And then we have three activists that are very different. Michael Skolnick is with something called globalgrind.com. He's worked with Russell Simmons for a long time on this coming together of music, philanthropy, and business, and how you see that kind of person like Russell Simmons impact the social space. We have Tara Roberts, who runs Girl Talk. This is really an outspoken media-based way in which people come together around topics. And then we have a woman named Min Dang, who has an organization called Don't Sell Bodies, which is around modern human trafficking, both of children and of women. And really this notion of a global issue that has a lot of resonance in Atlanta, because we know if folks have followed the issue that Atlanta is a hub for human trafficking because of the airport and because of some of the tourism that happens here. And so this group will be talking about their own specific issues and their own specific experiences, but then also commenting on what they see as far as trends go from a social change perspective.
You know, it's important to recognize the accomplishments of our elders and show them respect, and certainly the lions of the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 1960s that were there, still able to accept those accolades last week. It's wonderful to see, but really, activism, if it's going to amount to anything, is going to have to come from the younger generation, and it's fascinating to me. You've got some veteran talent in this event, but you also have some people specifically addressing the newer generations.
That's right. I think that one of the interesting things we forget is that many of those who led the movement in the 60s were in their early 20s. I mean, John Lewis was 23 when he spoke. Even Dr. King was a bit of an elder in his early 30s on that day. And so we forget in retrospect how young they were. I think we also forget that most of them talked about the movement as a human rights movement. They didn't really use the term civil rights. They used the term human rights, and they were thinking about it on a global basis. And I think both of those things translate well to today. Young people do have the ability, especially with social media tools, to reach a very large audience very quickly. And then on top of that, it does take a youthful perspective often to break down the barriers that we face today. And so I've actually been very heartened in our work building the center how open the elders have been to people taking the history but then applying it to new issues and applying it to in new ways as we move forward.
And, of course, younger generations are living at home more than previous ones and having a harder time finding a permanent, if you will, full-time job. So there seems to be a lot of intellectual, emotional, and physical capital going unspent in this country. And there's a real opportunity maybe to get these people activated.
Absolutely. There's no question about that. And if someone is not tied economically down, if they don't have a house yet, if they don't have a family yet, they often have the ability to really take a risk from a social change perspective. And I think we do have a large number of people who are in that situation right now. We also have a lot of folks who are from immigrant communities, who are new Americans, who want to shape America in a way that makes it so that they can be included and their families can be included. So there is a lot of pent-up energy. The other interesting thing is at 50 years, we often see that a historical event moves from memorial to legacy. World War II, we saw in the 90s do this, where people started to reframe the issues around the greatest generation and about what it meant going forward, not just in that time period. We're exactly at 50 years now, and I think you're going to see a lot of efforts to say the civil rights movement from the 60s means this to us today, even though we weren't there. Many people who were born after it still want to tap into it for inspiration.
You're listening to Community Focus on WCLK. Today we're talking with Doug Shipman. He's CEO of the National Center for Civil and Human Rights. We'll talk about that shortly. We're focusing, though, on the upcoming CNN Dialogues event, Modern Marchers, Lessons from the Front Lines of Social Change. That event takes place Thursday evening, September 12th, at the Carter Center. If you'd like to attend this event, you can find more information about the event and the center at civilandhumanrights.org. Doug, in 1963, the term social activist didn't really exist. Today, we've re-elected a president to office who began his political career as a community activist. What does it mean today to be an activist? And is it possible to be one without significant funding or the boost of multiple media platforms?
I think an activist today means someone who is trying to affect social change that is outside of themselves. You can be an activist for your own, your own well-being, but a social activist or community activist is really doing it in a broader sense. It can be in a small community, it can be around a school or a playground or something on a very neighborhood level, or it can be on a mass social scale. But it's really looking outside yourself and then trying to get the allies around it. Can you do it without money? Well, I think it's certainly easier with money in some ways because you can get your message out more easily and you can also pay folks to support the effort. But I think that we have seen some ways in which money has not played a role. There's something called avaz.org, and they do online petitions, and they get millions of people to sign an online petition around the world. Then they present that to the leader of a country or an organization or a company that they're protesting against, and they've seen change happen. It doesn't take any money except the running of the website. I think their entire staff's about six people, and so they are affecting global change with very little money. I think it can be done creatively, but you have to think about how you bring attention or how you bring a lot of people to focus on an issue that then requires a response by, you know, whatever it is that you're trying to change.
And, of course, Dr. King and the various lions of the civil rights movement didn't have the Twitter sphere, didn't have social networks. Viral back then meant more of something having to do with a chest cold than it did that much presence. So actually the opportunities for an activist in 2013 are potentially greater.
I think they are greater. The reach happens a lot more quickly. The challenge is, you know, Dr. King, when Bloody Sunday happened, it only took that being on three major news programs and the entire country knew what had happened on the bridge in Selma. Now there are, you know, many more outlets to get your message out, but fewer people are watching each of them. So you have to think about a strategy in which you are across Twitter and Facebook and also a magazine article and a television, and maybe you're doing a podcast. Whereas it used to be for them, you know, Meet the Press was watched by, you know, hundreds of millions of people. Now it's watched by a few million. So the times have changed. The challenges have changed a little bit. But I think that what you're seeing is a lot of creativity in the social activism space. And I hope that this dialogue is going to showcase some of those efforts.
One of the main sponsors of the dialogues is the James Weldon Johnson Institute at Emory University, your alma mater, I believe. Many people do not know who James Weldon Johnson was and why he's important. Among his many achievements was a degree from Atlanta University, now Clark Atlanta University, where we sit having this conversation. What else can you tell us that we might need to know or be interested to know about James Weldon Johnson?
Well, James Weldon Johnson was a real incredible figure in the early movement. So this is first half of the 20th century. He's a writer. He's a poet. He's a musician. He actually is the author of Lift Every Voice and Sing, that he wrote that. He also was an anti-lynching activist. There are some famous pictures from New York City of a lynching happened today. These flags that were hung on the streets in New York, that was all his movement. He and Ida B. Wells really were leading the movement against lynching in the early 20th century. So he's this towering figure. The James Weldon Johnson Institute was started by an old professor of mine named Rudolph Byrd, who really believed that James Weldon Johnson and the spirit of his academic achievements allowed a modern interpretation of what civil rights means. And so the James Weldon Johnson Institute not only does CNN dialogues, but it also does scholarly research on contemporary civil rights issues. Unfortunately, sadly, Dr. Byrd passed away a few years ago, and so CNN Dialogues is still a testament to his leadership and also the testament to James Weldon Johnson, who in many ways I think was ahead of his time when it came to organizing around social justice.
Truly a Renaissance man.
Absolutely.
You're going to be talking, I'm sure, about several issues coming up at the CNN Dialogues next week. Modern Marchers, Lessons from the Front Lines of Social Change. That's Thursday, September the 12th. 7 to 8:30 p.m. at the Cecil B. Day Chapel at the Carter Center. And I'm sure a couple of these are going to come up. From your point of view, what kind of issues were raised by the Trayvon Martin killing and the subsequent acquittal of George Zimmerman?
Obviously a very important case, a very troubling case in many ways. I think there are a couple of things. One is at every step, we were in trying to interpret what was happening through the lens of race. We were trying to interpret how would things have been different had Zimmerman been a different color, if Trayvon had been a different color, if the jury had been a different color. And no matter where you came out on that, it was clear that race was the central way in which we were trying to understand it. I think the other issue around it is this was a situation where Zimmerman felt threatened, and the law allowed him then to be justified in killing because he felt threatened. Now, whether or not he was threatened is sort of the interpretation, but the law basically reads, you know, the law in Florida read that if he felt threatened, then he had the right to defend himself. You know, was the converse true? Would, you know, was Trayvon felt threatened? Could he have done the same? We will never know. So I think part of this was a social issue around the issues of race and how they play today. I think the other was around what kind of society do we want and where is it that we actually think self-defense resides? Does it reside in how you feel? Does it reside in some other sort of tangible way in which we see it? And I think that raises a lot of questions as we move forward.
Former President Clinton pointed out recently that in many parts of America, it's easier to purchase an assault rifle than it is to register to vote. This is a very jarring juxtaposition. And it kind of feeds into the Trayvon situation, too, where let's all get armed to the teeth and be paranoid at all times. But isn't the issue of inconsistent regulatory policies, in fact, a key part of 21st century civil rights?
Well, rights always are sort of slamming into each other because we have the right to free speech, but we also have the right to assembly. We also have the right to religion. You know, the court has said you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. That goes beyond the right to free speech. And I think that, you know, President Clinton is pointing out that there are fundamental rights, voting rights and self-protection. Let's take gun out of it for a minute, but just the ability to be safe that sometimes conflict with each other or we prioritize them differently. And I think that that's an ongoing discussion in American history. We're always trying to see where are the limits to rights? How far can we push rights? How universal can we make them? but it's also about fundamentally different arguments. In the case of voting rights, obviously a lot of the regulation has been to eliminate fraud down to zero, that we want zero fraudulent votes. That's been the justification. On the gun rights side, it's been that we want everyone to feel as if they're completely protected all the time and that they have the ability to defend themselves at a moment's notice. Those are different kinds of priorities. And I think that there is some inconsistency as we look at rights and how they are defended or how they are limited that we are constantly trying to grapple with and trying to deal with. We had a CNN dialogues on the Arab uprisings a few months ago. And if you look at the different countries of the Arab uprisings have dealt with freedom in very different ways. And we're starting to see the fraying of that in Syria, in Egypt. And these are fundamental questions that any society is constantly trying to grapple with. Where's the limit to rights? How universal can we make them? And how do we justify various rights, especially when they conflict with one another?
Is it pretty safe to say that issues brought up by the Trayvon Martin case, we already talked about human trafficking and these voting rights issues, are all going to kind of be in the middle of the swirl of this conversation next week?
Absolutely. And I think the other thing that's in the middle, when you think about modern marchers, the demographics of the country have changed so significantly, not only in new populations, the rise of Latino folks and rise of Asian American folks, but 1 in 7 marriages in 2010 were interracial. And so now we have bi and triracial children, we have multiracial families. And that fundamentally changes the issues of race, and it changes the issue of rights. When something moves from those folks to my nephew or my uncle or my spouse, then you begin to see a change in the way that we think about rights. And that's very much into this conversation, not only where rights start and end, but also how do you organize? How do you organize a social movement when not everybody is from the same background? That's different. That can be different. And the civil rights movement, I think, is a great template. The March on Washington had 10 speakers. 3 of them were religious leaders, Protestant, Catholic, and Jewish, a very specific nod to the power of religion as an organizing tool. So those are some of those lessons that you can apply today.
Hey, who are we all going to hate on once we're all colored like coffee with cream in it, right?
When it moves from them to us, then it's hard to hate yourself, hopefully.
You are listening to Community Focus on WCLK. Our guest this morning is Doug Shipman. He's CEO of the National Center for Civil and Human Rights. And we're talking about the upcoming CNN Dialogues event at the Carter Center. It's called Modern Marchers, Lessons from the Front Lines of Social Change. That takes place Thursday evening, September 12th at the Carter Center. If you'd like to attend this event, you can find more information at civilandhumanrights.org. If we could, Doug, let's talk a little bit about the National Center for Civil and Human Rights. It's going to kind of become the intellectual and uplifting part of a very entertaining area downtown in Atlanta, right adjacent to the museum, the Coca-Cola Museum and the College Football Hall of Fame and Centennial Olympic Park. Where are we in the process of the National Center for Civil and Human Rights? So when are you planning to open your doors, and what can people expect?
Sure. Well, if you drive by right next to the aquarium in the World of Coke on Ivan Allen Jr. Boulevard, you'll see a 4-story concrete structure. That's our structure. We're about halfway through construction. We will open next May 2014 with exhibitions around civil rights history, contemporary human rights issues. And we'll also display the Morehouse College Martin Luther King Jr. Papers Collection, which was acquired a few years ago. And so this will be a way to talk about history, but also to talk about contemporary issues. Very high tech, very interactive, including a television studio where regular visitors can leave an oral history, but we'll also be producing programs. And I think to your point, it will create a new destination within a very vibrant area. College Football Hall of Fame will open on the other side of Centennial Park in August of next year. So you'll have CNN tours, college football, Children's Museum, Centennial Park, World of Coke Aquarium, and the National Center for Civil and Human Rights. I think what you'll see is that people who come to Atlanta will want to stay longer. The other is, from our topics perspective, the streetcar is going to link Centennial Park with the King District. So you can start on either end of Auburn Avenue and basically understand King, understand Carter, and then come to the National Center and see how they fit into a global picture. So I also hope that this is going to put Atlanta back onto the national stage, into the forefront of the national stage when it comes to conversations like the issues we've been talking about today.
So you're talking next May, so you're under a year in your countdown. How long have you been dealing with this on a day-to-day basis?
I came on the project as a first employee in 2007. It takes on average 13 years to build one of these. We'll build it in 8, so that's a long time, but it's still less than usually it takes. And we've raised about $77 million in order to build the facility, so it's going to be a world-class facility with a meeting space. So there'll be the things that visitors do every day, but then there'll also be trainings and events and meetings that'll be occurring as well. So this has been a labor of love in a lot of ways, but I also think it's a way in which Atlanta can be on the leading front of civil and human rights.
And, of course, it's in Atlanta, and if you're listening in Atlanta, you think, well, okay, another Atlanta civil rights thing, but when you look at the board of directors that you have for the National Center for Civil and Human Rights, it reflects American and global input. So this really is a global venue.
That's right. And we'll actually, when we open, we'll have relationships with major human rights organizations around the world, with the UN bodies that deal with human rights, with media outlets on a national and a global basis. So I think what you're really going to see is this is going to be a national institution that's rooted in Atlanta. And Atlanta has a very special legacy. We went through the period relatively peacefully. We have 2 Nobel Peace Prize winners within a mile of each other. Only one other city in the world can claim 2 Nobel Peace Prize winners. And so I think there's something very special about Atlanta when it comes to rights that other people nationally want to tap into and want to be a part of.
Well, it's an exciting time to be in Atlanta, and it's exciting hearing about this. And, of course, next week there's a chance to gather with these causes in mind. Thursday, September the 12th at the Carter Center, Thursday evening, it is the CNN Dialogues event, Modern Marchers, Lessons from the Front Lines of Social Change. If you want to find out more about that event and attending it, or you want to find out more about the Civil and the National Center for Civil and Human Rights, you can go to civilandhumanrights.org. Our guest this morning on WCLK Community Focus has been Doug Shipman. He is CEO of the National Center for Civil and Human Rights. Doug, thanks so much for taking the time to catch us up on things today.
It's a real pleasure. Thanks for letting me be here.
You've been listening to WCLK Community Focus, a public affairs presentation of Jazz 91.9 FM, WCLK, the jazz of the city. If you have comments or suggestions for our program, we encourage you to call the WCLK Community Engagement Line at 404-880-6211. I'm Rob Maynard. Thanks for listening to our program. News from National Public Radio is up next, followed by the Tavis Smiley Show.
We'll be right back.